memory of Reb Simcha Holtzberg. When we talk about the success stories in Israel, you know, sometimes we feel so depressed that Orthodoxy is always seen in such a poor light, and somehow with the politicians and Ein Mazal Yisrael, no matter what we do, we always have we're always thwarted, and it creates heartache. And here was a man who had the love and affection of everybody. And of course it's the beautiful story of the survivor who gives his entire being to others. What's interesting, and this I never knew when it all came out in the eulogies and the brief reviews in the paper about his life, but already in the Warsaw Ghetto he was called Simcha the Tzaddik. So it's not something that happened recently. Already in the ghetto he was Moisa Nefesh to sneak food in, to sustain people, and evidently his whole life went in this kivun. What's sad is something we come back to on the philosophical level, that once again you see that same trend, that people that are totally selfless cannot maintain family relations. And I didn't know this. I didn't know that he was divorced. He has two sons and divorced already 31 years ago. And I couldn't find a word about, you know, who the sons are and what became of them. All I saw is that they were sitting shiva at evidently Reb Simcha's home in Tel Aviv. But a legendary man, and a man who captured the image of the public here. The only criticism I ever heard of him, and I want to relate to that criticism, is people said he was always looking for the limelight. But I always counter that, if you'll forgive me, with a pasuk from the New Testament. The New Testament says, "The meek shall inherit the earth." And I once heard a comment on it that remains in my mind already after 50 years. The meek shall inherit the earth, and that's all they deserve. You follow me? So that's not a fair criticism. Mark, tell me if you have an answer for me after class. Okay. The meek shall inherit the earth. But that's not a fair criticism, because people like Aaron Rakefet, believe me, we don't turn the earth around and we run away from publicity and we would like to hide. And a person like Reb Simcha Holtzberg, sure, he loved publicity, but that publicity advanced the cause, made the Pitzuim feel better, enabled him to get more gifts of whiskey and liquor. I mean, the stories are legendary, of toys, of rings, and the man was overwhelming. And one of the nicest comments in all that was written was that one of the reporters asked him, Simchala, tell me the truth. You know, and the Israelis, with all their chutzpah, so this Israeli reporter asks him, can you still believe in God after what you went through? And his answer was magnificent. He said, don't ask me questions like that. He said, what I went through, how can you ask me such a question? But he said, the greatest gift I got from my parents was a religious education. That turned me into a mensch. That's a beautiful answer. He answered him right on. You understand? Someone went through Bergen-Belsen. Someone went through Auschwitz. Don't ask questions like that. Halacha l'maisa, there's nothing greater in the world than chinuch with Torah commitment. Okay. Anyway, I want to dedicate this year in his memory, Nebuch. There's so much tragedy here, but at least this is one person whose life was meaningful, even the way he died, you understand? If anyone could write the script, I'll never forget my time. Again, it's a different world. Maybe Chaim Sack, maybe Rabbi Sacknowitz will remember. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't your world yet either. But in my time, the person who was one of the mainstays of YU was Dean Zahr, Shmuel Leib Zahr. Do you remember him? Dean Zahr, he was in charge of student relations and the deferment, and he was a figurehead carried over from the rebel era. He had been associated with the yeshiva for so many decades. He was an old, in his youth, he learned in Tells. He was a litvish, a klugi yid, a Talmud Chacham. So I don't think anyone could have written the script better. In the early 60s, I think it was 62, I'm pretty certain. As you will know, there's a big Chag HaSmicha every few years. I believe this year there's a big Chag HaSmicha, but it's every 3-4 years, YU gears up. But what about the fact that they're ordaining rabbis in the years between? So they make a little party for the parents, for the rabbanim, a little achag hasmichala, low-key, minori. And there in the Beit Medrash of the yeshiva, Dean Zahr just finishes speaking, keels over, and gives back his soul in the Beit Medrash. And people said, you know, this was mamish, overwhelming, that a man who gave his whole life to the yeshiva dies in a second right in the Beis Medrash. The same thing with Simcha Holzberg. He attends the ceremony marking so many years since the bus that the Mechablim, the PLO, destroyed so many Jewish lives on that bus that was on a Tiyul, on the coastal road. And at the ceremony, there Reb Simcha keels over and gives back his life. Couldn't have written a better script. Okay, now I want to come back to the problem of Erev. And we've now spent many weeks, how did we get involved in Erev? We got involved in Erev with the concept that we don't create a Gezerah with our own mind, that today any Gezerah that we have from the Goinim stand, any Gezerah that are put in after the Goinic period, have no halachic validity whatsoever. And even though you can feel it's very important not to have an Erev because people will never know you're not allowed to carry, nevertheless, I showed you from a Tzvi Pesach Frank, I showed you from Menachem Kasha, that this cannot be a reason for opposing an Erev. Then we got involved with the whole problem in New York, and we tried to understand last week why Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens were so different. And when all is said and done, Reb Moshe Feinstein is in a bit of a difficult position, because on one hand, Reb Moshe is Mati the Erev in Queens, or the various Erevim in Queens. On the other hand, Reb Moshe is diffident or hesitant about the Manhattan Erev, but he doesn't come out against it. He says, if those that want to be Samach on it can. And then you get involved in Brooklyn, where tremendous machloket breaks out, and we'll deal with that later today, and Reb Moshe absolutely usses the Erev. And of course, what you're involved with is the whole question of the Rishut HaRabim, the Oraita, which again is another halachic principle, as we've said so many times. When it's on a rabbinic level, there's room to play with Shitat Rishonim and Shitat Dechuyot and Snifim. The minute you get on a Torah level, Safek the Oraita L'chumra. And of course, Reb Moshe says that even dismissing the Rambam Shita as most Achronim do, it's only the Mishkanot Yaakov, after all, who is so choshish for the Rambam's viewpoint that the Tetzlayinama, an opening of Tetzlayinama, is a Rishut HaRabim D'Oraita. But if you take Rashi and Tosfot and 600,000, it has to be, again, 600,000 has to have a limit, because if we're going to look at every place, it's interconnected. You ultimately, even in Israel, if you put together Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv, you have more than 600,000 people. So Reb Moshe explains, correctly so, you need the square, the Yud Bet by Yud Bet Neil, and if you play with the Yud Bet Neil by Yud Bet Neil, you're going to come up with the Oraita, certainly in Brooklyn, perhaps in Manhattan. Why is Manhattan different? And as we explained, Manhattan's completely surrounded with water, and you can get involved, of course, with the fences built around the water. Brooklyn is only surrounded on three sides by water. Queens, of course, all the Erevim there are much smaller. They're not as all-encompassing. And at the main juncture, the Erev does not include the highway. The tremendous highways, the Van Wyck and the Cross... What, I don't even know the name. What's it called? Grand Central Parkway, and there's a Cross Island Parkway in the Van Wyck. Queens is filled with highways. They're not included in the Erev. And it's true that the Kew Garden Hills Erev breaks. Where you get involved with the big Sheila of Queens Boulevard, and Queens Boulevard is a major, major highway, and in my own life, whatever the reasons are, I will never forget Queens Boulevard, and it's one of the funniest moments of all my years of teaching right here in the Kollel, but it's not for now. But Queens Boulevard is a major, major highway, 12-lane highway. And when you get involved with Queens Boulevard, and that is within the Erev, there you have 600,000 people shooting by daily. So I showed you last week that with Queens, they even went as far to put up these boxes encased in steel, and within the box, enough mesh that if, in principle, they could totally close off the highway with this door. And on either side of the highway, the boxes are there, the mesh meets in the middle, they have room from, they have permission from the borough of Queens. I imagine they renew it every few years, or they didn't have to, in general, get permission to build an Erev, to get Rishut, and to that they mavatl the Rishut to you, all of you know what I'm talking about. So, it shows you in Queens, they went to tremendous effort to work out the Erev, and even though they never were able to close the doors, but it comes back to the old principle of Kol Harui Bila Ein Bila Ma'kevet, and it's that as long as you have the doors there, perhaps B'diavad this is sufficient. Okay. But now, coming back to the Brooklyn Erev, I want to show you the Hetter. And this now is a classic case of halachic thinking. And this type of thinking goes all the way back to the Radbaz. We'll talk about the Radbaz in years to come. But all of our halachic thinking, the Radbaz's Tshuva and the Karayim, is a classic example. See, the Radbaz deals with the problem, and in his time it was halacha l'maisa. In our time, again, it's halacha l'maisa. Imagine the Karayim want to come back. And in his time, individual Karayim came back. All the time, there were Karayim that were returning to the Jewish fold. So you want to marry a Karaitic girl. Are you allowed to marry? Or does the girl have a din of Mamzerut? And what's the problem? The problem is that since they didn't observe the rabbinic law, so you always have the problem that the girl who's coming to you, maybe her parents were not married properly, maybe they were divorced, maybe the divorce was not proper, or not maybe, the divorce certainly was not proper, and therefore the girl is a mamza. And with anyone from the Karaitic world, you have a problem of suffix mamzerut. So the Radbaz, in a classic tshuva, which he repeats a number of times, says, look, a suffix mamza is only a din derabbanan. Once you have a suffix mamza, you can be mitzarev snifim. What does it mean, mitzarev snifim? So you start as follows. You go number one, perhaps originally they weren't married properly. If they weren't married properly, they don't need a get. Number two, perhaps they were married properly. They got divorced, so what are you worried that the get wasn't proper? Perhaps the woman never remarried. Next suffix, number four, even if the woman remarried, who said she had children? Number five, even if she remarried and had children, who said the children lived? Number six, even if she remarried and had children, the children lived from the second marriage. Who said the children went and remarried and that they had children? And he goes on and on creating sfeikot. By the time you get this girl in front of you, there's so many sfeikot that a suffix mamza is mutulavo b'kal Hashem, and the Radbaz is matir. Now, on the same level, this is what Rav Menashe Klein, known as Rav Menashe HaKatan, because all his tshuva is signed Menashe HaKatan, this is what the Ugava Rav does, and we started it last week. And he puts together many shitat. Now, every shita individually is not enough to be matir on. You can't be matir putting up an Erev in Brooklyn on the basis of one shita. But if you can put together six or seven big sveikot, or what we call snifim, then you have a very strong building on which you can be matter the Erev. So he begins, and I'm just repeating what we did last week. Number one, he raises the issue that since Brooklyn is surrounded on three sides by water, midioraita it no longer is reshut harabim. And it's only a reshut harabim derabbanan. Once you say it's the Rabbanan, yesh makom lahakel. Then he brings down many shitat that when we worry about 600,000 people, we never worry about people in cars, in buses, in trains. Because anyone in a car is in a reshut unto himself. And since you're in your own little reshut hayachid, you do not count as part of the general 600,000. And I remember in 69, you know, certain things stand out in my mind. Following 69, a lot of the years blur into one big blur. But 69, I was in Olech Hadash, and I remember at the encyclopedia, some wise guy worked with us from London, who has lived in Muncie for many, many years. He has a printing business going, and I understand he's done very well. If I'm not mistaken, his name is David Kupis. what's the name of Cooper Smith or something like that. Cooperfield, David Cooperfield, if I'm not mistaken. It's a real geisha sounding name, these English people. I have a girl at the Midreshet this year, Rebecca Godfrey. Go and convince me that's a Jewish name, you understand? But the English, evidently, they assimilated these geisha names. So David, if I'm not mistaken, his name was David Cooperfield, something like that, from some novel. It was a name out of a novel. So the first year I'm in Israel, he's on the front page of Marav, Erev Sukkos. What'd he do? He had a car with a skylight. He opened up the skylight. He put schach on top. And he says, this is a kosher sukkah. He measured the inside. Rubo nichnas underneath. You know how much it is to be a big sukkah. You just need the majority of your body inside. And boy, he was on the front page of Marav. The Olef from England builds the first sukkah on your car. I mean, Chabad has traveling sukkahs. They didn't have it yet, but Chabad has a real sukkah. They put it on a wagon. This guy did better than Chabad. He opened up the airplane and he put schach on top. The fact that the plane went under is a different story, but at least he was mekayem the mitzvah sukkah. If you take that point of view, you're right. A car, a plane, a train, no matter what you're on, you're in Rishut HaYachid, you're in a different Rishut, and therefore you cannot count for the 600,000. Now, and he brings that down too. And then the fact that the streets aren't open, that it's surrounded by houses, he brings down the Chazon Ish, that this too turns it into Rishut HaYachid, takes it out of the category of a Rishut HaRabim Dioraita. And then he gets involved with the whole concept of Mechitzat on Shabbat. That when we talk about Mechitzat on Shabbat, what are we talking about? Mechitzat on Shabbat, we're not talking about the Mechitza in this. When we talk about a Mechitza on Shabbat, its main purpose is that people should not be able to pass. Gidim Boken, as the Gemara, as Chazal explained it, and anything that's strong enough to keep a gedi, to keep an animal out, that's considered a good mechitza. And he says, in our big cities, people cannot walk freely everywhere, so that automatically there's a built-in mechitza, there's a built-in limitation on your freedom of ability to walk and do what you want in the public thoroughfare. And of course, if that's the case, it's a Rishut HaRabim, not the Oraita. It's no longer Rishut HaRabim, the Oraita. Okay, but then I want to go further. And here too, he gets involved in something which is very interesting from the point of view of political theory. Who owns the streets? Who owns the streets? And he says, in big cities, he quotes the Meiri and Eruvin, where the kings are the owners. So, look what happens. Even if the kings give permission for people to walk in the streets, nevertheless, they return the ultimate ownership. If they retain the ultimate ownership, then it's not a Rishut HaRabim. It doesn't belong to the 600 people walking in the streets. It belongs to the king. It doesn't belong to the people. Now, does this apply to a democracy? And here he says something very interesting. See, my gut reaction would be that fine, the king may own the streets, but this doesn't apply to a democracy. Who owns the democracy? The people. We own it. All the rules and regulations are representative of us, so that we create these legislatures, they create the rules and regulations, but it's not like a king. Ultimately, sovereignty goes back to the people, not to the king. He takes the opposite point of view. He says that even today in our cities, that the streets belong to the local government and we pay tax. Listen to this word. I don't know how they'll understand it 1,000 years from now. Ubiyata planning committee, lishanot lefi ra'ot einehem, ein kan reshut harabim, bayarot gedolot, v'chol shekein, al hadrachim, and he puts in parentheses, highway, sheshayach lememshala. Now, I don't know. This is open to a legal battle. You see the way he's interpreting it? And he may be right. Believe me, when a cop stops you and gives you a ticket, you feel the government owns it, not you. In Jerusalem, I've seen these foolish American kids, they don't realize they're in Israel. So the first lesson you have to tell American kids when they come in, I don't know about Canada, Canadian kids, but American kids, New Yorkers, the first thing you have to tell them is not to daven three times a day, not to worry, not to teach them about kashrut here and about the tudat. The first thing you have to tell them is don't cross against the light. Because in Israel, the driver does not expect you to cross. It's not like New York City. New York City, no one waits for the lights. It's an amazing thing. It's terrible. I pity the drivers in New York City. You look around, the cars are not moving, you cross. The driver has a green light and he's coming down, that's his problem. And all of New York, it doesn't matter. Cops, mayors, tzaddikim, rishayim, dope pushers, people who are walking and thinking and learning, everyone, it's just amazing. And I'm ashamed to tell you how quickly I become a New Yorker again. In Israel, sakonat nefashet. Not only sakonat nefashet, it's a sakonat for your pocketbook. Because they have these female cops out there, standing in the corner, they grab you, it's 50 shekel fine, it's mind-boggling how much money they make in the morning, they're like shills, and I watch them, they have certain places, it's amazing to see in Rehov Yafo, on Rehov King George, and they snap up the poor American. And they snap up the poor Israeli crossing against the light. So never cross against the light if you value your pocket and if you value your life. Some people value their pocket more, so that's why I put that first, etc. Now, this is open to discussion. I'm not sure he's right. But, see, he takes the point of view that the populace surrenders its right to the government. And that government, they are going to fence you in. You want to expand your house? You have to go to the planning committee. You can't do what you want. You can't build what you want. The public thoroughfare is not yours. My wife's grandfather, Rav Nachum Breuer, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, in East New York, every year he had lived in an apartment building like everybody else. His apartment was on the first floor. Every year he built a sukkah outside his kitchen on the street. Every year the Irish cop would give him a summons. He'd have to appear in court the next day. And every year the judge would look at the calendar, see when Sukkot would end. And depending upon how many days, he would tell him, Mr. Brill, you have 9 days in which to take that shack down. You have 8 days in which to take the shack down, according to the calendar. But the point is, the Irish cop was right. It's Rashid Tarabin. So you see, this too mitigates against it being a reshit harabim d'oraita, because you have planning committees, you have cops, you have laws. It's not a king. Again, I don't want you to debate with me, because you can take the opposite point of view here. But that's the point of view he takes, that this too. Now, then he comes, don't debate on that point. Yeah, go ahead, Gad. Right, well, that's what planning committee means. That's ultimately what it means. But you see, but that eminent domain, who created the government? In other words, remember, when you get a tzav giyus to the army, you're cursing mad. What right does that government have to put my life in danger, take 2 years, 3 years out of my life? On the other hand, who created the government? Is Rabin acting as Rabin, or is Rabin acting representing the will of the people? Aren't there these signs up all over on the terraces? Yesh mandat l'shalom. Latzeit min hashtachim bishalom. You follow me? And these people, they really believe democracy. You hear them on TV, and this is the question. It's a delicate, delicate question. I personally don't believe in democracy. I can tell you in advance that the next year I give in Woodmere is why I don't believe in democracy. I don't believe in democracy, but that's not for now. But this is the question here. Yes, Jay. They block it off once a year to show that they have private possession, that Rockefeller Center belongs to private. This is a big thing in Manhattan that would be a big satkula to help the Manhattan area. I'll tell you, Manhattan has a big problem because of Central Park. That's really the biggest problem there. When all is said and done, I think Central Park is one of the more difficult problems with the building of an area. Of course, there's a makom that wasn't built for, you know, for people to live, and it's the heart of Manhattan. Yes, Avraham. I have a lot more to say tonight, yeah. We'll come,
do me a favor, don't jump ahead. Relax. Okay. Now, then he brings down the Reb Kaveh the Chatam Sofer, and he brings down the following. And all the sources are there. That's, I'm not giving you the basic sources, because to give the basic sources on every topic will spend a year, but it's very fascinating. They too came up with other areas where you had big cities, and within the cities you had the rivers that froze over. So, as the Gemara says, the lonichu tashmitayu. Can you walk on water? People are afraid to walk. The ice will crack. It's dangerous. Once an area is dangerous to walk on, it's a reshut harabim, not the oraita anymore. It's only the rabbanim. So they say the same thing here. All the reshut harabim that we have, bizman hazeh, people are afraid to walk. What does it mean you're afraid to walk? You have to have your eyes open. Cars are speeding by. The minute you have to have your eyes open and you can only walk hesitantly, that too is another sniff why it's not a reshut harabim, the oraita. Okay. So this all continues on the same trend. The public thoroughfare, the walking, the cars, the police, the stop signs. But now we come to something very, very important. Yes, yes, sir. Well, I would have a feeling that the horse and carriages wasn't like today where there's so many cars fleeting by. I don't know, you'd have to check statistically. Somehow I have the feeling we don't come up in response literature with too many people being killed by horses and carriages. But you certainly have a lot of response literature on people being killed by cars, particularly in the Agudah area. So it would seem to me that was a much more minimal factor than the cars of today. The cars of today, you take Ocean Parkway, Queens Boulevard, how many Jews do we know that were killed on Shabbat trying to cross? Far Rockaway, Lawrence, that big thoroughfare there. I know a mother of students of mine from BMT was killed on a Shabbat just maybe 2 years ago. Do you know what I'm talking about, Abraham? What's the last name? Harris, I believe. Harris. Oh, excuse me? Rockaway Turnpike. And killed on Shabbat. I know in Flatbush and Ocean Parkway, Berger in the 1970s, this woman was killed in front of her children. Noah Lane on Shabbat, a Puerto Rican driver went up, dead drunk, went up on the sidewalk and killed her. Could you imagine on Shabbat? So, but now we come to something else, and this is very important. And this already you find in Rashi and the Ramban and many of the Rishonim on Masechet Eruvin. What is Reshut HaRabim? Reshut HaRabim, you need streets that go completely through, that are never blocked. Totally straight. What we call Mefulashim, halachically. When the Gemara talks about Sratya Platya, so one of the conditions the Rishonim put in is Mefulashim. Now, do we have streets that really go completely through? I would say the only borough where this may be a problem is Manhattan. Because Manhattan is laid out like a grid. And Manhattan is the only borough. Do you have that in Brooklyn? Absolutely. I don't know of any street in Brooklyn that goes on a straight line without curving. Straight? Straight? So that may be your only street then in all of Brooklyn. But Ocean Parkway, you have other shittah that it's not a reshut harabim because it's cars, it's not people. But in Manhattan, see, with all other cities that I know of, all other boroughs, certainly in the Bronx where I grew up, there's not one street that goes all the way through. And even Queens Boulevard, which I've ridden so many times, I've been driven on Queens Boulevard, I noticed that Queens Boulevard curves, tremendous curves, particularly when you start from the bridge, it literally, you can lose it. I mean, you can mamish lose Queens Boulevard. If I would be driving and I'd be a greenhorn to Queens, which I am, you can get lost. You don't know where it is. It curves. But Ocean Parkway is straight or it curves? So once it curves, you remove, once it curves, then it's removed from this category. But with Manhattan, I have a problem, because Manhattan is the easiest borough of New York. As far as I'm concerned, it's the one borough you can't get lost in. It's laid out like a grid. And there, once you're below Central Park or above Central Park, and above Central Park, obviously I'm afraid to walk, so I really can't tell you, but once you're below Central Park, you can walk all the way through from the East River to the Hudson River, from the Harlem River to the Hudson River. Am I right or wrong? It's literally an absolute straight line. But this is another viewpoint, and a very important viewpoint. This viewpoint is already found in Rishonim. This is a great sniff to be Mitzaref, but I'm going to go further in a second. Yes, Jason. Well, you're talking within Yud Beit Neil by Yud Beit Neil. Yeah, Yud Beit Neil area. In other words, again, everything has to be limited, because if it's unlimited, everything in the world is an island. I told you that last week, because you're going to be, say, surrounded on water by all four sides. So you'll say Canada and America, they're surrounded, the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Bering Straits, what's down below. You'll also find some body of water. But we're talking about within the Yud Beit Neil. But Manhattan really troubles me, because in Manhattan, I don't see this as a sniff. Unless you're going to claim where the streets begin, you see, you might make a different claim that the streets don't run all the way down to the water. And the truth of the matter is that Manhattan is so narrow that that would be within Yud Beit Neil. And I've seen people claim that since the streets don't run, in other words, when I tell you can go from one end to the other end, I mean from first, how many of you know Manhattan well? First Avenue, I can go over to, what is it, 13th Avenue? Well, how far can I go? 14th Avenue, but 12th Avenue. Doesn't go beyond 12th Avenue? All right, 12th Avenue, then it's certainly not far. But can you go down to the water? Do the streets begin at the water? Absolutely not. So even in Manhattan, you may be able to be mitzaref this sniff. By the way, in YU, you should know something about YU, that at one point when YU was built, that building in the 30s was the last building above the Harlem River. From the yeshiva down, it was called the House of God on the Hilltop, because from that point down, it was one big hill going down to the Harlem River. As a matter of fact, a student at MTA in the late 30s or early 40s fell down and rolled down that hill and got killed. A student named Markowitz. I even remember the name. I was like, I don't know about it then. I was a little kid. But I remember afterwards hearing about it. Zichron Levracha was a student at MTA, and the kids were playing, and he lost his balance and fell down the hill, and he broke so many bones that he died. So you can imagine, and today, of course, more of it is built up, but you still can't get down to the water. The streets begin above the water. So at that point of view, even Manhattan. But if you take the point of view that once the street begins, it has to run straight, Manhattan, literally, particularly below Central Park, from that point below the heart of Manhattan, 42nd Street, from one end to the other, 43rd Street, 44th Street, etc. Now, then there's the Aruch HaShulchan. And this Aruch HaShulchan remains a tremendous sniff that all the Achronim quote whenever they deal with Eruv, Bizman Hazeh. And he and the Aruch HaShulchan, it's in Simen Shin Mem Hei, Sif Yutet, and he comes in dealing with the Gemara, with Stratum Plach and everything the Gemara is talking about, and Eruvin, that it's wide open. He learns Pshat very simple. He says, you know where you have Rishut to Rabban the Oraita? When there's one main thoroughfare that everyone uses, whether it goes from north to south or east to west, is immaterial. But you need one main thoroughfare. But tzarich sheyed dafka mechuvan misha l'sha. And he brings down many sources from the Rishonim that this is the Rishut HaRabban D'Oraita. Well, if this is the case, then in no big city do you have a Rishut HaRabban D'Oraita, because there isn't a big city where there's one main thoroughfare. I admit, in Toronto, I was very impressed by Bathurst. But you don't want to walk on Bathurst? There's streets to the side of it, on either side. Cars are all over. People are walking all over. New York, where's their main thoroughfare? Take Manhattan. Ribono shel Olam. 42nd Street may be the most widely traversed street in the world. So what? You have so many other streets you can walk on. Brooklyn, fine. Ocean Parkway, I do not doubt, is a main thoroughfare. Eastern Parkway, when Lubavitch began, you fellas can't imagine, Eastern Parkway was the finest area in New York City. The wealthiest Jews lived there. Saturday and Sunday in Eastern Parkway, tens and hundreds of thousands of people walked Shomer Shabbos in their Shabbos finest, Sunday in their Sunday finest. So what? There are 100 other streets. If this Aruch HaShulchan is correct, you know what we get out of here? The result is that it's much easier to find a Rishut HaRabim D'Oraita in a small city than in a big city. Because by definition, Rabbi Nachum Kasher says this, many say it, because by definition in a small city, Yitaka might have a small city where they have one major place where everyone walks. By the way, in Europe, it's not too distant to see this. When the communists built, they didn't build big cities with many thoroughfares. They always was the main thoroughfare with the parade grounds. And as I told you, like in front of the Kremlin walls, where the people would come out to hail their leaders, all glory to the great leaders of the Communist Party, Mao Tse Rabin and Mao Tse Paris. I love that. Beautiful. You have no idea. That's press control and thought control. There you could pack and have a Rishita Rabin. But in a big city where you have so many streets, so many roads, according to Aruch HaShulchan, you will never find a Rishit HaRabim Bizman Hazeh. Yes, fine. That's what the Aruch HaShulchan says. No, one street considered a thoroughfare. Obviously, you have to have side streets, but this is the street where everyone walks, where I would say, this is the street where the activity is. Understand, people that want to use a street to go through the city, to transverse the city, to travel the city, this is the street. No, but they learn Stratia Platja means one street. The minute you have more, then you remove the unique status. It's no longer Stratia Platja. By definition, and it has to be a thorough street. See, everyone takes that too, it has to go all the way through. In a big city, you won't have it. A small city, you may very well have it. Now, as far as the bridges go, he claims that the bridges leaving Manhattan, leaving Brooklyn rather, all have a Tzirut HaPesach. He says this has been checked, and once you have a Tzirut HaPetach on the bridges, we already have the Chazon Ish, we have Reb Chaim Moser, we have the Igret Moshe, one after another, where they accepted a Tzirut HaPetach in their Tshuvah Halacha L'Maisa. And then he brings down another sniff, that even if we want to be Machmir, like the Mishkanot Yaakov, and even if we accept all the Chumras of the Mishkanot Yaakov, but the minute a city is surrounded on three sides, even the Mishkanot Yaakov would be Maida, that the fourth side you can be Machshir without doors with a Tzirut HaPetach itself. And he says, when it comes to Brooklyn, I've established that on three sides you're surrounded by water. On three sides, wherever you have water, it could be, as we said last week, the water itself is Mechitza. It could be the shoreline is Mechitza. And wherever you have water, you also have fences put up. So he says, in Brooklyn, we're surrounded by three sides. Even the Mishkanot Yaakov would have to be Maida. We can be Samach and Tzirut HaPetach on the fourth side. And here he brings down from Reb Shlomo David Kahana, who was the last Av Beit in Warsaw in the 1930s. You've heard the name Reb Shlomo David Kahana? Reb Shlomo David Kahana, I'll tell you who he was. You know, this year is Shemitah. So those of us that are Samach on the Het Mechira, who does the Het Mechira go back to? It goes back to Reb Yisrael Trunk, the Kutner Rav. It goes back to Reb Zalman Klepfisch. And who was Reb Zalman Klepfisch? He was an Av Beit in Warsaw. He was the father-in-law of Reb Shlomo David Kahana. that Shlomo, David Hanna, took the place of his father-in-law in the Warsaw Beit Din. He was a Gon Mufaki, who was rescued from Hitler, came in Aliyah, I believe, 38, 39, settled in the Old City, was evacuated from the Old City. He was a Posek Mufak, particularly in the field of Akunet. Everyone turned to him. He's a member, I don't know if he was formally a member of the Chief Rabbinate here, but the Chief Rabbinate consulted him many times. You'll see Reb Yitzchak Alevi Herzog consults him. This is Reb Shlomo David Kahana. His son is still alive and well. He must be a man in his 90s. Reb Zangvil Kahana, named after his grandfather, and he for many years was the Mankal of the Misrata Datot. Into the 50s, into the 60s, he built the Har Tzion, the Martefa Shoah. That is of Shlomo David Kahana's son, who Dr. Kahana. As far as I know, the man is still well. He has to be a man in his 90s today. Now, he was Machshir, the Erev, in Warsaw. And he claimed that the Erev in Warsaw would be good, even according to the Mishkan of Yaakov, because the city was surrounded on three sides. It was only the fourth side that needed an Erev, and once it's not a Reshut to Rabban D'Oraita, you don't have to be Choshesh for windows, for doors rather, and it's sufficient to have Tzuret HaPetach. So putting together all these viewpoints, all these Shitot, each one stands as a sniff unto itself, putting it all together, you have the framework for the Brooklyn Erev. Again, to say the Erev is only Mutal Lafi the Aruch HaShulchan, it would be a very weak Erev. But when you take the Aruch HaShulchan, and you take Lonichei Tashmitaihu, and you take the fact that the cars don't count, and you take the fact that we don't have the freedom to walk, and you take the fact that it's surrounded by buildings, and that there's no street that goes all the way through, and that there's more than one street, etc. When you put all these factors together and you reduce it to a Din D'Rabbanan, we can be Mekil. We can put up a Tzuret HaPetach Erev, and this Erev is Kasher Lahalacha. No, so far so good. But what happened here with the Brooklyn Erev takes us into the modern world. And here's where it's very difficult to separate the politics from the reality of the Halacha. And this is all part of, I would say this, it's sad even to have to talk about this, but there's so much literature and so much heartache that was spent that I have to give you the background and I have to explain to you. And this is all part of the talk I gave a year ago, I don't remember already, it's a year ago I believe, on Das Torah. You see, what's happened in the modern world, and it doesn't require anyone to be a great sociologist, what's happened in the modern world, the world before World War I. And the Rav always spoke about this. The Rav used to say, I quote him, "I'm not such an old man," he says. And I heard this from the Rav in the 50s. "Not such an old man." The Rav, let's say, was my age at the time. And the Rav said, "I remember when the norm was that every Jew was a Shomer Shabbos." Before World War I, this is true. Before World War I, 90% of the Jews were Shomrei Shabbat. Before World War I, the average Jew, it didn't matter who he was, knew how to learn a Daf Gemara. I can quote to you an editorial from the Yiddish Tageblatt that appeared in 1897 attacking the Jewish Theological Seminary. I cited in Bernard Revel. And in that editorial, they write, and I quote, "The Jewish Theological Seminary, they just issued a report that their students studied 19 blot of Gemara during an entire year." And the editorial says, "We laugh at this. This is a rabbi. In Europe, every balabas studied 19 blot Gemara every month, not a year." So obviously, when the world was normal and Shmirat Shabbat was the norm and people were learned, so what would happen? You had self-confidence. And if rabbis had an argument, you could participate, you could understand, you could have a viewpoint, you could understand why it's a legitimate argument. And you could paskin or do as you wished. We now have moved into a world where we've almost all become Hasidic-like. I mean, what was the Hasidic movement? Go back to the roots in Poland. Poland, following the Chmielnicki massacres, which ended in 1655, over 100,000 Jews were killed in 7 years. Polish Jewry never recovered from the Chmielnicki massacres. And Polish Jewry remained a breadbasket case until modern times. In Ein Kemachin Torah, people couldn't learn. And they were on the verge of spiritual assimilation. All of you know the Frankist movement. Jacob Frank was a Polish Jew. And here were Jews being led out of Yahadut, out of Yiddishkeit, into the Roman Catholic Church with some crazy hybrid religion of Catholicism and Mohammedanism from Shabtai Tzvi. And this was happening in Poland. Along came the Baal Shem Tov, and followed by his Talmidim, Rav Dov Be'er of Mezritch, Rav Avraham HaMalach, Rav Dov Be'er's son, and others, they developed the concept of the Rebbe and the Chassid. And what does that concept really mean? It means that there's really one Tzaddik and one Lamdan, and the masses cling to him for spiritual sustenance. And this was a Hasidic concept. I don't have to tell you that the Vilna Gaon dismissed it, the Litvakim fought it. Over the years, Hasidus certainly in certain parts, like in Poland, underwent a rejuvenation, and certainly Kutz and Sachchav, and for the sake of argument, Ger, certainly were Hasidic movements that once again put great stress on Torah study. I would say that in Poland, at least in the last 100 years, even the Hasidim stressed the exoteria sources over the esoteria sources. In the Ukraine, for whatever the reasons were,
Nathan Goldberg, Gad Dishi, Eli Schick, Jason Nepel, Avram Goldberg, Jacob Rosenthal is getting ready to return. Where is he? Jake, tell Jacob, I think I didn't bring the tape. I think I have it in my briefcase. I'll look for it because I see them have the tape. I have it in a different briefcase. Jake Pazner is here. Mark Feder, Shlomo Holman, Uri Cohn. Uri Cohn. Don't see him. Avi Belmo. Did Avi Belmo? Don't see him. Zev is here. Yaakov Kermaya, I see him. Morty Heckel is here. Evan Barth is here. Morty Heckel, Evan Barth. Okay. So, in modern times, look what happened. The Litvisha world has developed the same type of thinking. And we turn around our Gedolei Torah, and we literally treat them like Rebbeim, and we cling to them, and we put them into a certain aura, literally like a Hasidic Rebbe. And this happened with this controversy. Tremendous outcry developed. How did Reb Menashe Klein dare to differ with Reb Moshe Feinstein? And I'm not telling you ancient history. This was the 1980s. I'm not telling you ancient history now. And thoughts were thrown around that are in the antithesis of Torah. For instance, I'll show it to you in a second. Lotana laharav, that there's a lav dioraita paskin against the gadol hadar. And people quoted this. Intelligent people quoted this. That there's a lav dioraita to paskin against the gadol hadar. Lotana al harav. It's frightening. But this is what happened. More than that, when the Aver was finally put up in Brooklyn, students went and ripped it down. Mamish ripped the Aver down. How can you do a thing like that? As I told you many weeks ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to boast, no? That he never carried on Shabbos. But in Chaslovich, he got 2 kopecks a week for checking the Erev every Thursday. The Rav, I heard this with my own ears, and I checked with others. Everyone heard it. You can check with Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik. It's It's not esoteric. It's exoteric. And Ribbono Shel Olam, and here in Brooklyn, you go and you rip the Erev down. I don't know, they might have even ripped it down on Shabbos. They're Lamdonim, Makalkel, Pata D'Oraita. And if you rip it down a minute before Shabbos, and here are people that are going to be Samach on the Erev, thinking there's an Erev, and they literally ripped it down, and words were said, like damn Moise Nefesh on building the Erev, we have to be Moise Nefesh on destroying the Erev. These words are frightening. But the only way I can understand it, because halachically, there's very little to deal with here. As a matter of fact, what I'm going to show you is very sad to me, how Rav Menashe Cotton has to defend himself against such attacks. It's very sad, because we punish a lot of and you know, it's amazing how things have changed, because in the 1950s, when Rav Moshe was Matir, AID, he was attacked and he was vilified. And now in the 1980s, anyone differing with Rav Moshe is attacked and vilified. And this is, it's the symptom of the world in which we live. In other words, it cannot be taken out of the sociological context. Halachically, how can you defend such a view? Well, Tana la Rabba, we're going to take that viewpoint. All psak halacha comes to an end. Ribbono Shel Olam. Rav Ovadia Yosef was mati, you know, right after Sukkot was a kohen to a grusha. He was Masada Kedushin for a Talmud of mine who's a kohen who married a grusha. So we wanted to find out. We went in to find out what's happened. His son said to us, my father's the biggest lamdim of the generation. He doesn't have to justify himself to anybody. Well, when you talk like that, Yiddishkeit has come to an end. Because you can be the greatest lamdim, no one takes away from your lamdis and your rad shemayim, but halacha belongs to all of us. And everyone who's a lamdim knows and has to be on that. And this is the ongoing process, and you can't hide your thought process. And there has to be a machloket, and it can be a machloket, fine, it's l'shem shemayim. But only with the understanding of what's happened with Das Teira and the Good at Israel in America and the Art Scroll series and books come out today for children. I mean, I shake. Yeah. And again, I'm in a different generation. I told Jack that talk I gave last year was the most brilliant talk I ever gave in my life. It's the only time I ever listened to a talk again. I heard the whole talk via video again. I watched the video of Das Teira, and it was the worst talk I ever gave, because that talk should have been given to 20 people in a closed room. It had no business being given to the public, because the public didn't know what I was talking about. I'm talking to those who know what Yiddishkeit is about. The public today is living in a different world. It's a different world. I'm not with this world. I admit it. I'm proud to tell you, I am not with this world. Thank God, those of you who take my Tuesday class know what the Rev had to say about individuality. Just last week we dealt with it. Am Yisrael and Goy Kadosh, etc. Okay, and it's frightening what went on here in the 1980s. Lotalna Harav, how dare you? And Rav Menashe Klein was singled out because he was the biggest Lamdan. He's Mamash Lamdan Mufak. And he wrote all the Kuntresim, and he was Matayerev. And the Machloket was frightening. Now, quoting to you from, again, I apologize, I gave you the sources where you find it already in the volumes that are hard bound, but quoting to you from the Kuntri Sharei Halacha Choveret Yud Gimel, beginning on page Lamitet, he's writing to a very important person, Reb Simcha Elberg. No, who is Reb Simcha Elberg? Chaim will tell you. First of all, he's a survivor from Warsaw, a first-rate Talmud Chacham. Unfortunately, no children. I know him personally. Brought out Hapades, the American Rabbinical Journal, from Rabbi Pades of Reb Shmuel Aaron Pades of Chicago, had this Rabbinic Journal. Journals become very valuable. Does anyone know why? It's an amazing thing. They make money. Why? How come papers are given out for nothing and they're published every week? They make money. The truth is, the New York Times could afford to be given away for nothing. It would still make money. Advertisements. And when you have a rabbinic paper, it's not just advertisements. Rabbis want to have their weddings published there. So when you open up Hapades of all the years, every other issue, you read about the greatest wedding in the history of the Jewish people. There have been so many great weddings, it's unbelievable. And they tell you about the wedding, they tell you who was there, a long list of 50 Rebbeim and Rabbanim that came to the wedding. No, one word about the Chatan V'Kala. Ribbono shel Olam, when you write about a wedding, you have to write about the chatan v'kala. Forget about the 50 long beards that were there. The chatan v'kali, they're going to make or break their lives. But it becomes very valuable. Did you ever realize that? This is why Hapades, he brought it out, he can teach it, and he's a serious Talmud Chacham. And he evidently accused Reb Simcha Goldberg, accused Reb Menashe Cotton. And listen to his words. Et Nidaraya Shalem, and Reb Simcha Goldberg is a big shot in the Agud and Harabonim. And look to what Reb Menashe Cotton has to write. Ash Basefet Rashiyam Kodish Bagud and Harabonim. V'yashmacharai kol rash gadol, asher heviru kol b'machane lomar, hevitu acharei Menashe. Can anyone tell me what other tshuva begins this way? Remember I quoted a tshuva to you over the years? Kuf Chaf Hei in the Ramah. When the Ramah was Masada Kedushin Friday night, and he has to justify himself, he begins exactly with these words, habitu acharei Moshe. Here it's habitu acharei Menashe. And he says, people said at the Aguda convention, look what Reb Menashe HaKotten did, that he was matakin a rufin by a rut gedolet by America, that he permitted big cities to have a rufin. And he went against the Gon and Posek Adam Maron, Reb Moshe Feinstein, and Reb Moshe Feinstein asses, and it's asur lachlok al Reb Moshe Feinstein. And he says, I promised you then that I would answer the question, and now I'm keeping my promise, and I'm going to answer. And he goes in here to a long discourse. No, let's develop it halachically. Where is there a din of Lotan El Harav in the Sanhedrin? What do we do in the Sanhedrin? So what's the Yates of Chazal? Who do we begin with first? We always begin with the smallest lamdan first. He should say his piece, and it's psychological. Since he's speaking first, he can say what's on his mind. He's not going to be intimidated by those that come after him. And Reb Menashe HaKotten adds, and I think he's absolutely right, it's not that it's an isa to disagree, lo kana laharav. In the Sanhedrin, there's 71 members. Each one has an opinion. But he develops it. Well, Tana al-Harav means psychologically, you won't speak freely. God, in His infinite wisdom, when He gave us the Torah, gave us a system, the Torah Shabbat Peh. How do you get everybody to speak freely? Lo Tana al-Harav, begin with the smallest, the newest, the least educated. Let him speak first. That way, he will not be intimidated. He will say what's on his mind. That's number one. Number two, tell me, does Lotan El Harav apply outside of the Sanhedrin? Do we have that concept? Absolutely not. Once there's no longer a Sanhedrin, every Talmid Chacham has a right to state his opinion. Isn't this the famous Rambam in the Hakdama to Mishnah Torah, where the Rambam deals with the whole problem? Why we cannot argue with a Maskana of the Gemara, and why we can have so many arguments among the Rishonim? I mean, the simplest example. I was just talking before class with Jason Nepal. We were having a little chat on Halacha. I'll give you a simple example. A person wants to have chicken and salad cream. No, he can say, I pascha like Rabbi Yossi HaGlili. You have a brit on Shabbat, you forgot to prepare the knife, you forgot to get the mohel, so you'll call up the mohel on Shabbat, please come, do the brit, the mohel will get into his car, drive, do the brit, and the mohel will say, I pascha like Rabbi Eliezer. No, the Gemara in Shabbat, of Kuflamad, the famous Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Then the Gemara deals with it. The Gemara says, he came to this place, they gave him chicken and milk, he threw the guy into Chayram, no, he had no right, he passed like the... How come today we can't play this shtick? In America today, you'll have an organization, women and men, men and women I should say, who refuse to accept the Chumrah Benot Yisrael, that they're always Chayshesh for Zavah Gedola, and they count Shivanikim. The Bnei Shlomim. In America, it will be the largest organization of modern Orthodox Jews. I shouldn't only say modern Orthodox Jews. Plenty in the black world will join, except they'll join clandestinely. That's the difference. The modern Orthodox will join in the open, they'll join clandestinely. How come you're not allowed to do this? Oh, would life be great? You don't have to worry about Shiva Nikiyim, just count Shiva days, sometimes becomes unwell. Men in America are oversexed, whatever it is. Terrific. Terrific. And this is the Rambam, Ribbono Shel Olam, we cannot argue on a maskana of the Gemara. Beyond that, we argue with everybody. And he goes through a long example of the Talmidei Beit Shammai, Talmidei Beit Hillel, and the Rishonim, and the Balmor, and the Ramban. And no one ever said. No one ever put the halachic process to an end. How can you say? We're going to stop arguing. Not only that, he quotes the Ramah. Didn't we spend so many weeks in this wonderful classroom? Didn't we spend so many weeks on Klolim L'Psak Halacha? And didn't we see ultimately when all is said and done, the only klal is that there is no klal? That ultimately is the Mora D'Atra that counts? And that the little Mora D'Atra, you can come in and you can be Mekil where all your predecessors were Machmir. Or you can be Machmir where all your predecessors were Mekil. And Shlomo can ask a simple question. Who are we? What are we? With all due respect, Reb Heschel Shechter can give a psak different than Reb Chaim Meisel. Is Reb Heschel Matir Gelatin? Tell me, Shlomo, you're his Talmud. You're his Talmud, right? Reb Heschel's Talmud. Is he Matir Gelatin? Do you know? Let's say, for the sake of argument, Reb Heschel Shechter is not Matir Gelatin. Reb Chaim Meisel was Matir Gelatin. Well, what are you going to say? That who gave Reb Heschel the right? You understand? This is the ongoing process of halacha. That when all is said and done, the Talmud Chacham, who's sitting there at that moment with his mind, Yiftach b'darach Shmuel b'darach, Bnei Shel Olam. And then he goes even further, and he says, Reb Moshe's introduction. Remember, we all go back to Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe basically only wrote one introduction where he deals with the halachic process. What introduction is that? To Chelik Aleph of the very first Digrot Moshe. What did Reb Moshe say there? Reb Moshe writes, I don't have a right to Paskin. I'm a nobody. I don't know enough. Reb Moshe, look in. You'll see. He says, how can I differ with Reb Kivega? How can I differ? But Moshe says, all I'm doing, he says, is giving you the sources. You work them out. If you agree with me, fine. And if you disagree with me, that is your inherent right. So Reb Menashe Katan writes that I am doing exactly what Reb Moshe says I should do in his Hakdama to Aruch Chaim. It's unbelievable. You know, it hurts me. You know, Jay, you know what's bothering me? While I'm telling you all this, I'm saying to myself, what's the Chiddush? But these are the times in which we live. That imagine at the Agudat HaRabbanim, they went up and attacked him. What did Menashe Katan Klein do? He's a Shagetz, he's a nice fop, he's this, he's that. How dare he differ with Reb Moshe? He Bnei Shel Olam, what did he do? And then he tells a very fascinating story. And here is fascinating material. Reb Moshe has a famous tshuva. Look, when you have a valuable hat, we Jews, see, I always say, being a Jew, you always have to suffer. It's inherent to your very being a Jew. I'll give you an example. Every other person in the world is the master over his own little destiny. More or less. Aaron Rakefet, there's nothing Aaron Rakefet likes better than a cup of coffee. I do not touch coffee. Strictly forbidden. Why? Because I want to fast Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. The other fast days I would be Mekil. I'm not any bigger tzaddik than my Rebbe, than the Halacha. The minute you get a headache, break the fast, no big deal. But Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, and I have that caffeine. I can drink soda, I love cola, I can drink tea. I love coffee. It kills me. I don't touch coffee. Don't touch it. But you. Now, take Shabbat. Your beautiful clothes. Now I'll share with my share. Beautiful clothes. Everything is fine. Everyone knows they have beautiful clothes. You, when it's raining, you take an umbrella. Come Shabbos, it's raining, it's pouring. A Jew cannot take an umbrella. Okay. So Rav Moshe has the following question. We own hats. Believe me, the most I've spent on a hat in the last 30 years is $10. I buy stupid hats with ear laps because my ears are sensitive. Imagine you have a shtreimel, a Hasidish hat, a black fedora. The rain is pouring on Shabbos. And if you don't come to your shul with a black hat in Toronto, I saw some shuls, I looked in, it looked like 200 people looked exactly the same. The suits exactly, the hats exactly, the pigment in their faces exactly the same. Some boat ship, a boat shul, something there, a boat shul, I don't know what that means. Now, so what, no, who can tell me what Shiloh made? This is the famous Shiloh. Saul is right. The plastic on top of the hat. A hat on top of a hat. Rav Moshe Rasses. Rav Menashe HaKotan was matir. That's the whole problem of carrying. A raincoat, late mandapolik, you're allowed to wear a raincoat because it's normal to wear two coats. The raincoat is not the end of the world. But when it comes to a plastic hat, it's a hat on top of a hat. When all is said and done, most normal people don't wear two hats. Rav Moshe Rasses. Rav Menashe HaKotan is matir. So he tells the story, and all the sources are in here. He tells the story how Rav Moshe, he went to see Rav Moshe when this machloka took place. It was in the 60s, late 50s. At that time, Rav Menashe Kotten was a little kid yet. He was in his 40s. How? And he felt very bad. He's differing with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Maybe he was in his 30s yet. He's the exact age as Eli Wiesel. If you'll tell me Eli Wiesel's age, that's the age. Menashe Klein and Eli Wiesel were childhood chavruta in Europe before Hitler. They learned together by chavruta. So they both were teenagers when the Holocaust ended. So Menashe Klein felt bad. It's like I went to Rabbi Lichtenstein. I apologize Friday because this Wednesday we're both giving memorial lectures. One drop. He's giving a shiur here in memory of Rabbi Freeman. I'm giving a shiur in Machon Lev in memory of Murray Simon. I'm speaking on secular endeavor. Different topic altogether. Secular endeavor within the Torah framework. So I apologize to Rabbi. I felt bad. You know, it's not nice. The Gadol Hadar is giving a shiur and I'm giving a shiur at the same time. Mamish the same place. But what can we do? You know, when the family asked me, I said yes. I never dreamt there would be a conflict like this. So Reb Menashe Klein went to Reb Moshe, and Reb Moshe told him, you can argue with me, you can differ with me. And Reb Moshe, he writes, Natan li reshut l'chalek alav, v'lo rakshe natan li reshut. Elisha, he peel chova lachlok alav. He said, it's an absolute chiyuv to argue with me. And he said that this is the only way we finally reach a conclusion in halacha. And he says that people mafalpil zeim zeh, and you have every right to argue with me. And Reb Moshe, not for one minute, told me I'm not allowed to argue with him because I'm younger and less learned, etc. And then he brings one of the most beautiful proofs of all. It's a Mishnah. There's so much in this Mishnah for us. Mishnah in Ediyot, Parak Aleph in Ediyot. All of you know, Mayim Shuvim Poslim Et HaMikva. What does it mean? Mayim Shuvim Poslim Et HaMikva. How is a mikvah built? We have to have Mem Tzah Mayim in a mikvah that's not Mayim Shuvim. In Israel, how are they Machshir a mikvah? They're waiting for the rainy season. They catch the rain. And this Mem Sa Mayim Shuvim is Machshir the Mikvah. Once you have Mem Sa Mayim Shuvim, by the way, in parentheses, what was one of the greatest halachic machloket in New York in the 1950s, where Moshe was involved and he was a great mekil, the Mikvah in Far Rockaway. How are they Machshir the Mikvah in Far Rockaway? With ice. Remember, with ice, with snow, they brought in snow and ice, was a big question, and this and that. But in Israel, we wait till the rain, we collect it in a bar. Once you have Mem Tzah Mayim, you can have all the faucet water in the world, it all becomes kasher. And generally speaking, I don't want to go into mikvah now, but generally speaking, what we have is a burn, the mikvah, with an opening called hashaka, nishika, and all the water in the world comes in. Once you begin with memsa, the mikvah is kasha. Fine. The machloket in the Mishnah, Hillel Omer, but before you have memsa, water from the tap can passel the mikvah. Right or wrong, drawn water, you're drawing the water before you have memsa, it can passel the mikvah. Hillel Omer, melohin, maim shuvim poslim et hamikvah. Shami Omer, tisha kabim. Chacham rim lo kedivrei zeh, v'lo kedivrei zeh, elad shabo shnei garbayim, mishash pat shvirushalayim, v'yidu mishim shmai v'aptayon. What an amazing Mishnah. Shammai Hazakin and Hillel Hazakin were having a machloket. What is the shear you need to passel the mikvah? And along come two weavers who lived where? They lived in Harlem. Who do you think lived in Shah Shpat? No. Where do you think they lived? I heard this from the Rav once, very dramatically. Shah Shpat, the poorest people lived there. Why was it called Shah Shpat? The dung gate. No? Why? You tell me, why do we call the dung gate the dung gate? All the refuse from the Beit HaMikdash was taken out through that gate. All the smells, all the leftover, the blood, the animals, the Bnei Shalom, you can imagine what it smelled like. No? Anyone who has money lives in Woodmere, lives in Lawrence, lives in Muncie, lives in an isolated area in Flatbush, where every house on the block costs $1 million. Who lives? A million above and a million under. You understand what I'm saying, God? They lived there a good life. No? Yaakov, who lives near the Shah Shpat? The poorest people. And who were these people? Weavers. Not giants of Torah. Not great Talmidei Chachamim. Weavers. Rikimu Chavei Chachamim et Divrehim. Why? Because they said it over in the name of Shmai Rav Talyam. And when you have a tradition, tradition can knock out even Shammai Hazakein, even Hillel Hazakein. And he goes on so beautifully, he says, what do you want out of me? He says, I have a tradition. I saw the way they paskened in Europe. I saw in the world in which I grew up. I saw that in every city they had a Reuven. How can I not defend my viewpoint? How can I not continue my tradition? How can you push me down and gag me? If what you're saying is correct, how did the Shnei Gardiyim, the two weavers, have a right to come along and talk against Shammai Hazakein and Hillel Hazakein? Very powerful. I love this because this is so beautiful. I can tell you in parentheses, sitting in this room are many of us who are Balei Tshuva, whatever that means. I'm not going into it now, because I'm a partial Balei Tshuva. I always say I have the advantages of a BT, although I'm not really a BT. But think for a moment how powerful this is. Shnei Gardiyim, Bishah Ashpat, and they throw over Hillel Hazakein, Shammai Hazakein. Look up the Mishnah, it's a powerful Mishnah. And he says, Minhag Danag al Omer Mikadma Danai, he said, I saw this in every great city. And now, you want me to come along and you want me to keep my mouth shut? And he quotes the Gemara in Yavam, it's a Gemara we dealt with many weeks ago, and we dealt with Minhag, Minhag Koveya Halacha, quotes the Gemara in Yavam at Nafkuf Bet, Omer Rav Kahana Maravim Yavoli Yavim Ein Chotzin Menel Shomalom. Ein chotzin besandel, ein shomen lo. Shekla nahagu ha'an besandel. And he says, Ribbono shel Olam, even Eliyahu HaNavi could not throw over the tradition that we use a sandal for chlitza. And if this is the case, how can you want me to throw over the tradition that they built a ruven throughout the millennium in every city in Europe? And then he says, this talk that they want to Ein Chokim al Harav, and they yell, Kavod HaTorah, he says, this cannot be, this is not true. He says, there are so many examples. He says, there are tens and maybe hundreds of examples where Reb Moshe Feinstein himself differed with others. And he cites, didn't he differ with the Minchat Yitzchak? Didn't he differ with the Chelkat Yosef? The Chelkat Yaakov, Reb Yaakov Breish? Didn't he differ with the Otzar HaPoskim so many times where they bring in different viewpoints against Reb Moshe? He says, I'm doing just like Reb Moshe does. When I have halachic truth, I have to state it. I will merely push it. And here he comes again. Future generations will have to struggle with his English words. Shehu inyan shel politika zola shel kama anashim shebeshvil politika shelachem rotzim levazot ulashpil kavod haTorah kvodot harabanim ubetochem gam kvodot shemaran hagoyim Reb Moshe Feinstein bekof aleim chaki gigit ובכן מודו רב לא ראיתה, והתורה ביהבה, וברצון היחילנו, ולא בשוטים, תרתי משמע. His words here are very powerful, he says. It's all cheap politics. And it's all people who force others to listen to their point of view. If I may put it into my language, it's all this concept of das Teira, of one way, of a steamroller, and that no one can think anything differently. It's all part of the same syndrome. Imagine Reb Heschel Schechter comes to an Agudat Israel convention. Believe me, if I could get hold of Reb Heschel before he went, I would have ripped into him and told him, how dare you go there and sit down with David? But he went. It's a covet for Agudat Israel. No, instead of being makabel him, Reb Heschel Schechter, a golden idea, walks into a convention of Agudat Israel. It's a few, not ancient history. No, instead of being makabel him b'kavod, you all know what happened. I don't want to go further. It's not worth talking about it. But there was a busha, a chepa. Refused to go on. That is, top tuli left, wouldn't speak, etc. But this is the world in which we live. It's like a steamroller. It's a play on words on the Gemara in Shabbat, on the Gemara in Shabbos, that if you don't accept the Torah, if you don't accept my viewpoint, and he says, look what he says, and let me make it clear, moda'a rabba li'oraita, let me yell and shout at every street corner, ha'Torah bi'ava baratzon hichilanu, this is not the way we act when b'nei Torah have a machloket. V'lo shotim, shotim tate mashma. You get the plan words? V'lo shotim, you don't use sticks to beat people to accept your view, and you don't act like shotim, like fools. Shotim tate mashma. And then he says very strong words that in Israel you could sue the guy and throw him into jail. U'kol shekein shebredifatam et rabbanim sheinu maskim lahem. When they are rodef, the rabbis who don't agree with them, who mamash redifat shel hanatzim rachmana litzlam v'yoylehem ulenafshotehem hargomim bizayon hatorah v'lomdeha v'gehenem kala v'hein einam kalim v'nitzal otot sadek me'atovon. Very strong words. He compares his oppressors to the Nazis, and this is a person who suffered under the Nazis. You call someone a Nazi in Israel, he can sue you in court. Generally, he will win. People have been thrown into jail for calling the police Nazis. You understand, the police beat the hell out of people at demonstrations, and then they're thrown into, and then they call the police Nazis, and then they're arrested for desecrating a police officer, calling them a Nazi, and you can be thrown into jail. And he goes on and on defending himself before Reb Simcha Elberg, and he says, and he ends off, he says, these are the words of a little man, a person that always seeks truth and honesty. V'shochev gav askufa hanidresetachle ragle chachme hatorah mitiyim. He says, when I throw myself on the threshold, let any great Talmud Chacham stand on me, step over me. Halomdim otol lishma, those that study Torah lishma, lasot nach ruach l'mishama v'haya olam min olam v'yad olam b'lev v'nefesh minasha hakatan. And this is his famous letter to Reb Simcha Elberg, defending his viewpoint, defending the fact he has a right to differ with Moshe with all his love and respect for Gedolei Yisrael. Our question is, why the letter? Why? It's Sil Kri Be'Rafu. But these are the times in which we live. You cannot remove this machloket without understanding. You cannot understand it. You cannot remove it from the political, social happenings of the early 1980s in the United States. Against that background, then you can understand it and why all these extra halachta factors play such a big role. Now, he didn't only have to deal with the Agudat HaRabbanim. He didn't only have to deal with Rav Simcha Elberg. I won't finish it all there, but I'll just give you the insight. Lakewood Yeshiva, by now, the early 1980s, Lakewood Yeshiva is a prime mover on the American scene. And as I said last week, and I don't pull any punches here, I don't know whether Baron Cutler delivered a knockout punch to YU, but he certainly stopped YU in its tracks. There's no question. I'll talk about it Wednesday night. There's no question that before Baron, YU was on its way to conquering America. With the arrival of Baron Cutler, YU is stopped in its tracks. And with all the greatness of YU, even today, it still has to take in consideration what they're saying in Lakewood about us. And Lakewood is a major, this is the heart of literature learning. And in Lakewood, there was tremendous bikoret against Rav Menashe HaKotten Klein that he dared to argue with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, he has a number of letters. They're all from 1981. And they're evidently to he's writing to Harab Yosef Geld, a Talmud in Lakewood, Neched Yedidi Gon Reb Chaim Geld, and he speaks about his grandfather, Gon, my dear friend, Lakewood, New Jersey. So in other words, this Yosef Geld who he's writing to is a grandson of someone who Reb Menashe HaKotten is very close to. And here I want to summarize. You find all the sources in it. Continues in this chovera that begins on page 9. Now, what the Lakewood guys, and someone said this to me last week. I think it was Avram asked me the question last week, 2 weeks ago, privately. And it was a very good question. And I told him I would get to it. I'm getting to it now. You know, if you take Rav Menashe HaKotten's viewpoint and you take all these kulot and you mitzaref them, so why were Chazal so concerned with Shemi Yavirenu Dal Ramot, that you don't blow shofar and Shabbat, Shemi Yavirenu Dal Ramot? And it's a good question. If you can build an Erev so easily, why so much concern? So many gezerot, Shemi Yavirenu Dal Ramot, Yishutarapim. But first of all, I can answer the question at a very simple level. When Chazal were choshesh, it means even for a small minority they were choshesh. We don't know where we're going to live, we don't know where we're going to grow up. The pendulum swings. You all know my vat that I'm proud to say. I've had a number of occasions now where I said things throughout the decades, and then I heard the Rav say exactly. Remember, I studied only with the Rav 4 years sitting in front of him. I have to be honest with you, I've studied infinitely more with the Rav not sitting in front of him. So over the years, I used to say this vort. Now I give credit to the Rav. It's my own, but I heard the Rav say, so Yisimcha Benik Efraim Menashe. You know my vort on that? Why Efraim Menashe? What's wrong with Yitzchak, Yaakov? So the Rav says so beautifully, and I said it over the decades, because when you bless a child, now the child, I bless my children, my grandchildren, those grandchildren are my slaves today. I brought them guns after Shabbat for Purim, and the 3-year-olds we should ask, were you good in Shabbat? Did you turn on lights? No. Can you turn on lights on Shabbos? No. When can you turn on lights? After Havdalah. Can you eat lollipops on Shabbos? Yes. Can you have cake on Shabbos? When all the questions were answered, the guns came out from behind my back. Those guys, I own them at the age of 3. They're not dummies. They want the guns. They want the gifts. They're in my possession. They're going to grow older. I don't know where they're going to be. I don't know where they're going to live. Yisimcha Elokim k'Efraim u'Menashe. No matter where you live, you should be like Efraim u'Menashe. The first Jews to grow up
under the worst of circumstances and to be total Torah Jews. So the same thing here. Shami Avirenu Dal Ramot. When I was growing up, an Erev was as distant from me as China is from me right now. The Erev was as distant as the man and the moon is from this cup of water that's in front of me. So you don't know where you're going to be. Baruch Hashem, we live in a world I've carried now for 25 years outside of two or three Shabbatot when the Erev fell down in Yerushalayim due to snowstorms or something else. You fellas live in Flatbush, in Borough Park, in Manhattan, in Riverdale. Whoever dreamt there'd be an Erev in Riverdale? Whoever dreamt they talk about an Erev of Manhattan? And Rabbi J.J. Schechter, others, they're machshim, making proven. Again, I don't know all the details. You can't even keep up with all these details. Who would ever dream that there'd be you're living, Chazal or Chayshash? Because in the course of the millennium, Jews would be living in Russia. And even, I want to tell you, even in Russia, during the dark period, Machanayim built an Erev in a courtyard in Russia, being Seicher Rishut from the communist term that he was a Jew, in his youth he had learned in a yeshiva, the communist guy, was masked them the Rishut, the courtyard, a little courtyard of Moscow. I saw it, they had an Erev Chatzairot there, had there were fences, don't ask, it's made it Tzuret HaPetach, even in Russia. So that's why Chazal were Chayshish. But there's a second side to the coin. We have a tradition throughout the generations of so many Erevim. It's part of Yiddishkeit. And here he quotes the Tshuvah HaRash. I don't find it now. It's right here. You'll find it in Reb Menashe Katan. And the Tshuvah HaRash is very important. And it's exactly the question we would want to ask. Ribbono Shel Olam. All our life we grew up, Abar Rishuya Tain, there's Rishuta Rabin the Oraita, there's Rishuta Yasha, there's a Carmelit, there's a Mokum Tur. All our life we grew up like that. All our life we grew up, that's an Isid the Oraita, to carry Rishuta Rabin, Dal Rama, to be Machnes, Rishuta Yasha, Rishuta Rabin. Suddenly you're going to come along and you're going to build an Erev where it's Tzuret HaPetach and you're going to be Matev, be Mitzav Shitat, and cars, yes, no cars, people, yes, no, how they walk, how they go. They're even Shitat, I didn't even go into it, they're even Shitat that the 600,000 has to be 600,000 Jews, 600,000 men could very well be, you can't count women, you can't count children. No, if that's the case, show me one Rishut to Rabin the Oraita, Brooklyn, where do you have 600,000 Jewish men walking the streets? It's impossible. Statistically, it's impossible. If you don't count women, you don't count children. How many men my age already don't walk? Children don't walk. You have to count the adults, 20 to 40, 20 to 50, the guys that work for a living. I don't know. So this guy has to rush. He says, I don't believe in this whole thing. Why are you playing games to build a Tzuret HaPetach and everything? And the rush answers him, you're an Apikoros. You're a Karaite. And the Rush, it's a Rishon. He says, this is our tradition. He says, I order you to build an Erev. I think he gives him 30 days in which to put the Erev up in his community. And he says, you're not because. He says, this is our tradition. And this is exactly that. Reb Menashe Katan goes into a long history. He tells these Lakewood boys, he says, I don't know what's the matter with you, he says. If I thought you didn't know how to learn, I would say you're not Lamdanim. But he says, I know your grandfather, and your grandfather's a fine Lamdan, and I've heard wonderful things about you. I don't know who this Joseph Gelb is. Maybe some of you know him. But he says, I heard wonderful things about you. He says, you know how to learn. You know this Tshuvah HaRash. Look it up. And he says, what about Amsterdam? What about Rotterdam? What about Paris? What about Warsaw? And all these cities had a rhythm in modern times that the Machshirim, Reb Chaim Weiss himself, was Machshir the Erev in Paris. We saw Rav Shlomo David Kahana was Machshir the Erev in Warsaw. So he says, well, how can you ask this question? How can you attack me? And then he goes on with the terrible words. He says, how dare you rip down the Erev in Flatbush, he says. And he quotes the words I quoted to you an hour ago that they said, we're Moshe Nefesh to put it up, you're Moshe Nefesh to take it down. He says, how dare you? People want to be Samach on an Erev. How can you interfere? And then Reb Menashe Katan goes into a whole discourse, he says, and this I was laughing, he says, I was in Yerushalayim. He says, in Yerushalayim there's no less than three Erevim. And I never carried in Yerushalayim. I myself don't carry.
what the Yerushalayim is referring to? It's true. I couldn't believe it because most people don't know. Yerushalayim, there's the Erev of the Rabbanut. There's a larger Erev, which is not as large as the Rabbanut, but extends and it has many areas of Jerusalem of Agudat Yisrael. And then there's a much smaller Erev of the Eid HaRedit that only goes to Rehov Yafra, I believe. I believe Rehov Yafra is the point in which the Eid HaRedit Erev ends off. To them, that's the end of Yerushalayim. You reach Rehov Yafra, you're in a secular world. Yerushalayim is over. So he says, I was in Yerushalayim. You know, so I'm reading this 100 years, I wonder what he's talking about. Three different Erevim, he says. And I didn't carry. But it doesn't mean that I don't have the right to build an Erev for those that want to be Samach on the Beit Ephraim. And finally, he gives the long history of how the Erev began, and the names he mentions are very fascinating. Because what happened with the Brooklyn Erev, and I would say, I'm ending off with this, I know it's late, but I would say it's unique in the history of Torah. You know who the big pushers of the Erev were? So-called modern Orthodox rabbis, headed by Rabbi Shachman Schlitter, one of the most distinguished of American rabbis, the rabbi of the Young Israel of Flatbush, Rabbi Zalman Shachman, and he and his colleagues, and the Satma Rebbe, the other Rebbeim, all those from Poland who had a tradition to be Samach on the Beit Ephraim. They didn't follow the chumras of the Mishkanot Yaakov. So he says, he gives all the names, he tells the story and the history and how they came to him, and the Flatbush Erev, the Borough Park Erev, he discusses the train in Borough Park, the Tzuret HaPetach. Very fascinating and an anomaly, because here are Arsi elements joining with Satma and Hitachtus HaRabbanim joining together hand in hand to put up an Erev. Now the letters go on and on, because these Lakewood guys write back to him again and another time, and he says, if not for the fact that I love you, I would suspect you're out to kill me. You know, he writes back, he says, he knew darn well what was going on. I would suspect you're not L'shem Shemayim, but since I love you and I know your grandfather, I will once again explain myself. But this is the theme, it goes on and on. And this Choveret, there's another Choveret, and this is the whole story in of the Brooklyn Erev. And I don't know what the status is today. From what I'm told, there is an Erev. No one rips it down today. The world has made its peace with it. There are those that do carry and those that don't carry. And that's the way it should be. Gentlemen, to reiterate, in our final shiur in Shelet and Shivet and Halacha, before the great Chagim Habayim Aleinu Letova, next week at this time, we will all be drunk. 2 weeks from now, I don't know if you'll be drunk, but I better not be drunk, because I'm giving a shiur in memory of my Rebbe, and I can't afford to be drunk when I give a shiur in memory of my Rebbe. And that will be the final shiur before Pesach. I will not be saying shiur that Tuesday. We have shiur this Tuesday, next Tuesday, Bezrat Hashem, in Rav Soloveitchik. But once I give that public shiur, for reasons that will become clear to you 40 and 50 and 100 years from now, it will be my final shiur before Pesach. Gentlemen, to reiterate, what did we do? What did we do today? We finished up the Tzir of Snifim. It's mamish, a replay of the Radbaz, and this is classic halachic tradition, how you put our chetet together. In addition to the halachic material, I gave you a little bit insight to the heartache of Rav Menashe HaKatan, ad kidei kach, that he has to say, you're being robbed of me like Nazis. And this is a survivor of the Holocaust speaking. It's a sad commentary. But what he calls the politics, I will call the sociological, political reality of American Orthodoxy in the 1980s. I would like to believe that by the year 2000 it will change, but Be'ezrat Hashem, that is still beyond us, we'll have to do our share. I'm not overly optimistic, but who knows, miracles can happen. They've happened before, and this is why we celebrate Purim. This is why we get drunk on Purim. You know that, again, I always say over my own, and I heard it later from the Rav, it's amazing. Why do we have a mitzvah? Chai v'an lo sumi upurnia, ad lo yada, whoever heard of such a thing, to get drunk? And the Rav said so beautifully, because the heart of Yiddishkeit is to teach a person to be logical. This is what we Lithuanians believe, learning and rationale and insight and being organized in our thoughts, but ultimately,